now. Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Well, our guest tonight has one of the most recognisable and much-loved voices in Australian radio. For more than 20 years, millions of Aussies listened to him count down the hits on Take 40 Australia in the 80s and 90s. He's interviewed some of the greatest names in music in the music industry and shared their stories with the world. It is my pleasure to welcome to Great Australian Lives, Barry Bissell. How are you?
I'm very humbled. I'm good, thank you, Laura. It's nice to meet you.
Yeah, some incredible times for you back then. Take 40 Australia is, of course, the first and longest running music countdown in Australia. It was broadcast 100 stations, over a million people a week, massive audience. You did the show for 21 years.
Mm. Yeah, it's quite a long time.
Before we go any further, I just want to play a little bit now just to jog people's memory, to get people in the mood.
Take 40.
Barry Bissell here. The guys from Powderfinger will be helping me count down the nation's 40 biggest songs on Take 40 Australia this week.
Baby, I got you.
And we'll be giving away tickets to an exclusive Powderfinger show, plus news on how you could share in $100,000 worth of prizes. It's all on the show with the biggest hits and the biggest competitions, Take 40 Australia.
Looking back on that time, same show for 21 years, you must have some great memories.
Oh, I do have some great memories. It was an amazing time. It came about quite by accident, Take 40 Australia. I was at Fox FM. In those days, we were out at Nunawading in the Channel 10 building. Yep. And we used to run an American Top 40 with Casey Kasem on a Sunday night, and it was boomer. That used to come to us on disc or then later CD. Mm. And we played it for years and it worked really well. And then in 1984, a young bloke from who'd been at 3AW, ironically, in the sales department, came out, he's a bit of a salesman, wanted a job at Fox. He thought it was the up-and-coming thing.
Yep.
Tony McGinn, and he said, I've got this great idea. Elton John's coming to Australia. You can interview him. Then we'll turn it into a radio special and sell it to radio stations all over the country. And I said, well, it's not how it works because radio stations don't pay for specials.
Yeah.
We, you know, contract it or, you know, do a barter deal. So he said, oh, and I said, also, it's a one-off. You know, they won't do it. And he said, well, what do you think? And I said, well, Take 40, American Top 40 works really well. Why don't we do an Australian version? And we got Ed Nimavol on board, the great writer, and he came up with the name Take 40 Australia, which to this day I never know what really meant. but we started recording. We used to record in a little studio at Fox, which we got to use, and they were the only station that went on air with it. And then we went to 3SH in Swan Hill, which was my hometown, and they broadcast it. And then Coca-Cola came on board and Tony just marched it out to all those stations and it just kept rolling.
It was huge. I mean, it is a part of people's childhoods, teenagehoods, certainly part of mine. I mean, I remember, you know, you'd be recording the music off the cassette deck back then and every song, thank you very much, Barry, has you talking over the start of it.
I get that from everybody
I've
ever
met. I bet you
do,
but that was your job, to introduce every song and to outro every song. But, you know, when you're sitting at home pressing record on your favourite song, you're encapsulated forever.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry about that, everybody. Apologies yet again.
Don't worry. It's not like I'm playing the tapes anymore. Don't worry.
Going behind the scenes, of course, I used to just record the voice tracks.
Right.
And then somebody would assemble it and put all the stuff in.
Ah.
So I really had no say. It sounded like I knew what I was doing because I talk right up to the start of the vocals.
Yeah,
like
you would.
Some genius, which I did do for some years.
Now, that answers it because I often wonder, how do they time it to such precision to know when to shut up because they're about to start? And I mean, obviously you'd have a timer in front of you, but it actually was produced that way.
Mm, all smoke and mirrors.
Yeah. Now, that we have a little clip now of you back in 1994 with Delta Goodrum. You've spoken to some huge stars over the years, but let's go back to 94. This is Barry and Delta, and you using some of your really, you know, your knowledge about music with a very young Delta. Here she is.
Gary Bissell, one-on-one with Delta Goodrum. Now, Delta, back in the 70s, before you were born, Bruce Springsteen had some dramas with his manager, which meant he wasn't able to record for a couple of years. And when he returned, he had a song called Something in the Night, which included the lines, "You're born with nothing and better off that way. Soon as you've got something, they send someone to try and take it away." Can you relate to that?
I think lots of people can relate to that. I mean, there's been a lot of people trying to come into the picture again and trying to take things when I go, you know what, this is ridiculous, and I work really hard for this, but then you go, well, you just got to understand it's part and parcel with the job, and I guess that sometimes these things happen, and it's a good line.
Doesn't make it any easier though, does it?
Of course it doesn't, and sometimes we wish things were easy, but they're not, so we've just got to deal with them the best way we know how and step over the next hurdle.
Now, that's a very young Delta that we're hearing there. You must feel a little bit nostalgic that you are often part of the early careers of people like Delta, who's now huge. Mm. When you see her now, do you think, gee, I was there when it all began for her?
No, I think, you know, she was such a beautiful girl.
Yes.
And I've got a great photograph on my files somewhere of her leaning on the piano in the studio looking like she should be on the cover of Vogue magazine. And I thought,
beautiful girl, I sat down
with that girl face to face.
Yeah.
She was lovely.
And you, 1984 is when it all started, when Take 40 Australia started. And they were the days, you know, where we'd be listening to Madonna and Cyndi Lauper, Phil Collins, Lionel Richie. Do you remember the first, that first set of music that you were playing back then?
No. I'd know what it was if we had a listen, but 84, Madonna, Phil Collins, definitely. Mm. Mm. I couldn't pick the songs exactly. It's a long time ago.
What would it take to make the show? Was there a lot that went into it?
Well, writing and research. We had a couple of great writers. Ed Nimmervoll started, and then Jeff Jenkins, who was I still am friends with, and we still do work together. Fantastic researcher and an amazing mind and love of contemporary music. He just comes out with all these facts that he's got stored away in there.
Yeah.
And he makes it really entertaining. A couple of times we'd be doing something and say, oh, yeah, I remember this, and, you know, a spark off it. But he was a creator. He was fantastic.
I think you've answered my question. I was going to ask whether it was live or pre-recorded. It was pre-done.
Yeah.
But that... That would help in shopping it out even further, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It went very wide, this show.
Yeah, very wide. It's a large audience all over the country. But, and we were able to source old material for interviews and get stuff off YouTube and stuff, which JJ particularly was great at finding.
Did you find that you were interviewing big stars every week, or is that something that sort of came later as the show got bigger?
Not to start with, no.
Yeah.
No, it was hard to get him initially. Mm. But I had interviewed Elton prior to that, and I think that was Tony's whole idea, because Elton actually came out to Fox in Nunna Wadding in a limousine wearing a fluoro pink tracksuit with bright green stripes across it and a matching pink baseball cap.
Mm.
And one of the kids from Neighbours, who was completely besotted with Elton, had come in from the studios at 10 and said to me, do you think when Elton comes I could come in and meet him?
Yeah.
And I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll make a deal. He's arriving at such and such a time out the front, and if you're here, accidentally talking to him, I'll introduce you to him. And I did, and he was thrilled with that. Christian Schmidt, I think. Yeah.
Elton was a hoot too, wasn't he?
He was very funny.
Yeah.
Very funny man, very generous with his time, and just a fabulous person. His publicist, Paddy Mostyn, the famous Paddy Mostyn, who is still a friend of mine to this day, rang me and said they'd been listening to me on the radio, and Paddy said, Elton's listening and he's quite happy, if you like, to come out, do an interview live on air with you. We can do 2 hours.
Pretty incredible. Elton John is listening and he wants to come to Nunna Wadding.
Yeah, of all places.
It's Elton John. Of
all places.
Yeah.
But he loves his music. He really loves music.
Yep.
And the deal was that if he came out and did the 2 hours, he could select 3 or 4 new cuts to play on air, which he did. A couple of them became hits. You're going to ask me what they are now, and I've got no recollection. But he did love, he loved, it was the very early days of Crowded House, and he loved Crowded House. He said, oh, it's interesting. He said, I'm actually going to Neil Finn's house for dinner tonight. Mm. And he said, I've got a terrible memory. He said, have you got any idea what his wife's name is? And I said...
I was going to say you could Google it, but you couldn't then,
no,
could you?
No, no. And I said, it's Sharon. And he shrieked and threw his hands in the air. And I said, what? And he said, how could I forget that? He said, Rod Stewart's been calling me Sharon for the last 30 years. That was his nickname.
Did he say why?
No, that was just, they had a nickname for each other, and I can't remember what Rod's was, but I always remember, you know, he'd always refer to Elton as Sharon for some reason.
How funny.
Yeah.
Did you come across Elton again in your career?
Yeah, several times.
And did he remember you?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Isn't that the mark of a nice person?
Yeah, very nice person. Yeah.
And obviously very intelligent man.
Very intelligent, and I find his talent extraordinary. He's doing his... World tour, and he's doing something like 387 dates.
Amazing.
He's my age. Mm. He's heading on for 73, and he just never misses a beat. He plays every note with those little chubby fingers, and he never misses a note. And his voice is still incredible. I've got total admiration for him. His body of work is just amazing.
Do you know what I love about him as well? He is not afraid to collaborate with people like Lady Gaga and younger artists who some older people might look down on or feel, maybe even feel threatened by, but he's so secure in himself and so confident that he does that, and he'll collaborate with these young up-and-comers and who would be in his eyes. And still make good music with them. And that's different, I think, to a lot of other people of his vintage, that they wouldn't go there.
No, definitely. He was unafraid. As you said, he was so secure. And Ed Sheeran is one of his greatest fans.
Yep,
he says
really?
Elton kind of paved the way for every songwriter like him. And he references Elton in Castle on the Hill, which is one of my favourite songs.
Yes. Right,
you know,
song.
Riding down country lanes, singing along to Tiny Dancer. And I think, what a lovely thing to do.
Yeah, that's beautiful. After 20 years or for the stretch of 21 years, did you ever come a bit tired doing the show? I mean, how do you keep it fresh every week?
I did towards the end, to be honest, because I'd kind of outgrown the music. Mm-hmm. My whole reason for being in radio right from the word go was because I loved the music. Mm. That's what got me into it when I was back in Swan Hill in 1966. Mm. And there's a moment that I can share with, if you like, about what actually got me into radio.
Yeah. We'll talk about that later.
I didn't have the passion for it anymore, and I honestly felt announcing some of these songs like a fake because I didn't enjoy it, and I was trying to sound enthusiastic about it, and I felt like a fraud.
The honesty is refreshing. A lot of people would stay there and keep, you know, taking the paycheck and pretending, but you obviously weren't comfortable with that.
No.
So my next question was going to be, was it difficult to walk away back in 2004, was it?
Yeah, 2004.
Was it hard? Yeah. I mean, you still feel a bit torn, wouldn't you? Even though you've outgrown it, you've been there for so long.
Well, I had a handover lunch to Andy G with...
who has also been on this show.
Yeah. Not with Tony or anybody, and I picked him up and we went and had lunch and sort of did the official handover. And he was up and coming, and I'd known him before, and I thought, it's in good hands, so I'm quite happy with that. And he liked the contemporary music more than I did, so it seemed like a no-brainer.
Well, don't go anywhere. There's plenty more still to come on Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives, and more with Barry Bissell when we return.
Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tonight we are celebrating the life of one of Australia's most recognisable and enduring radio talents in Barry Bissell. Barry, you were born Sounds like this is your life. 1947 at Swan Hill District Health. And back then, Swan Hill, little farming community on the Murray. Great dad. What a great place to grow up.
I didn't think that when I was...
Oh, I'm sure.
When I was a kid. When I was... Well, particularly when I became a teenager, I thought, what the hell am I
Get
doing
Get me out of
this?
Here. Yeah. Yeah.
And, but in retrospect, I wouldn't change anything about my... young life because we had such freedom in those days. And I used to ride my push bike out to Monangatang to stay for the weekend at a school friend's farm with his family.
Yeah.
And I just think nowadays you couldn't ever do that. You know,
you'd be peddling away with probably your thongs on and your shorts and
yeah.
no helmet, just... Down a country road.
Yeah, thongs and stubbies and that was it.
Beautiful. Now, your parents, Hugh Melville Bissell was dad, Dorothy was your mum, and dad was a World War II veteran, I understand, who'd been a navigator on Lancaster bombers.
Yeah, yeah.
So he had his own story.
Yeah, he had a wonderful story, my dad.
Was he one of those who wouldn't talk much about his...
Hated talking about it. He found it really difficult. I think there was with a lot of those guys. I didn't really find out a lot about it until he died, and I found his flight diary from his days with the RAAF, and they flew Bomber Command, it was called, with the Flying Fortresses, those huge, great four-engine planes that did 13-hour flights out of Edinburgh over Germany, dropped their bombs and came back. He had to log in his log the tonnage of bombs they dropped. It was devastating for him.
Yes.
And I think he felt guilty. He said,
of course,
I was bombing innocent people.
Yep, yep.
And, it was a real awakening. And I had much more respect. Well, I had a lot of respect for him anyway, but even more
when you
after
saw
I read
it
that,
on paper.
What he went through. Yeah. And I understood then why he didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. Do you feel like he was a damaged man?
Yes, well, to a degree, but also I think as a young bloke, doing something like that is so extraordinary. The adrenaline they must have felt, it's a huge adventure.
Yes.
And even though it wasn't great adventure, everything after that is just kind of bland. It just drifts away.
Yes, you have to come down from it.
Yeah.
I know my own grandfather went, and I think lots of people like him did, signed up at 15 for the adventure. You know, it was a way out of the current sort of might have been a boring life or whatever in Australia, you know, and they lie to get their way through and get there on the adventure and then sort of reality hits, doesn't it?
Yeah. Dad wasn't in that situation. He signed up. He was a bit older. He only served from 43 to 45.
Yep.
And it had gotten really, really
so
hardcore.
Later on.
And they were calling for any assistance they could get. And he immediately joined the RAAF and trained as a pilot.
Mm.
The navigation part of it came later. He did it out of Queensland and Canada and all different places and then got put into Bomber Command.
Mm.
It just, he didn't really have any choice. I think he signed up because they were desperately in need of people. He was in the middle of studying at university by that stage. He was studying to be a doctor.
Right.
But his dad and his grandfather had both been optometrist opticians in Footscray for years. The name, you know, the name still means something out there. And Dad was born in Footscray.
Yeah.
He was studying to be a doctor and break away from the family tradition of optometrist opticians. Mm-hmm. So he's midstream doing medicine and then signed up, went away for 2 years, came back and finished his degree, a shortened degree, and like his dad and father,
ended
grandfather,
up an optician.
Optician, yeah.
Now, your dad and mum ran the optometrist in Swan Hill, didn't they? And you lived in a little house out the back.
Well, behind the storefront, yeah.
Do you remember those days lovingly? Were they good days?
Yeah.
As little Barry in the optometrist in Swan Hill?
Well, yeah, I used to, after school, I'd go in and help in the store. There was only Dad and his receptionist there, and he would do the eye tests and she would take all the things. And like a typical young kid, I fell in love with this girl and said, I'm going to grow up and marry you. which never happened. She was considerably older
was
than
me. Was she aware?
Probably.
Now, Mum Dorothy, she was not a Swan Hill girl to begin with. Did your parents meet in the city?
Yeah, they met in the city.
How did he talk her into going to Swan Hill?
Well, when he came back, when he completed his degree, there was a shortage of people all over, and they were trying to resettle different country areas and get people away from the mainstream to open up the state. So I think there was some sort of incentive to go to a rural centre, which they just send doctors. They have to, just because nobody's going to choose to go to Swan Hill.
Some might.
Well, yeah.
It's still a nice place.
Yes, it is. It's a nice little, but it's dry and it's worse now. Mm. It's just completely, the landscape is just completely denuded. The Murray's just a little trickle. It's been sad to watch, yeah. Mm.
I was up there a few years ago for floods, actually. Mm. I haven't been for a few years, so it must have dried out a bit.
I remember huge floods when I was a teenager there. We were marooned.
Yeah.
All the roads out of Melbourne were underwater. Out of Swan Hill were underwater. It was bizarre. Yeah, not anymore.
Did you ever have ideas about becoming an optometrist or optician yourself?
No, I think
Dad did. Because you helped in the business, didn't you? So Dad wanted you to be, but you had other ideas.
I think, I didn't know, to be honest. I was not particularly academic at school and I didn't want to go to university. That was kind of my trajectory until I think it was 15 when the music changed, when that whole Beatles thing, that whole social revolution, which it was more than just a musical revolution.
Yes.
They were the sound of it. But it was changing all over the world. 3 years later, we had the Summer of Love, and it was a really powerful movement. And I'm so glad that I was there at that time to experience that.
You got swept up.
Yeah, got totally swept up, and I had no choice. And there was a moment when in 1965 I was doing year 12 and feeling not very excited about doing anything, loving all this music and listening to music. I used to have a transistor, crystal set headphones that I plug into a little radio that I'd built, and listen to 2UW and Ward Powley Austin and 3UZ in Melbourne, which was the big music station at the time.
Yep.
I used to, set an alarm to wake up because I'd worked out the rotation of songs, and there was I remember Spencer Davis Group, Give Me Some Love, and I just loved. And I worked out that 2UW played it every 2 hours. And I would set my alarm and wake up, put my headphones on and listen to it, then go back to sleep.
So young Barry had, you might not have known yet, but a love of music and radio that would become your career.
Yeah.
Before that, though, you were part of the Swan Hill Theatre Group.
Yes. There's a wonderful woman called Marjorie McLeod.
Yes.
Who was a Shakespeare nut.
Okay.
And she was a beautiful little woman.
Yes.
And she was so passionate about it, and there was an amateur theatre group. I was sent to her for voice training because I can't remember how this came about, but I ended up playing a role in an ABC radio play.
Mm.
I got this role as a kid called Anne, Woman on the Beach or something it was called. I was ill and I was on stage, this is a stage version, but the ABC one that was just standing in a studio and doing the talking. Marjorie said to me, "You've got to project. You've got to project your voice." And she used to smack you on the diaphragm and make you breathe out. Mm. So you could, when you were in live theatre, your voice could be heard. I'd had a nasally, nasty little voice, and all of a sudden,
I think Australia has Marjorie to thank because we end up with Barry Bissell, the very well-known radio announcer who brought us the top 40 every week.
Yeah, she was a wonderful woman.
Now, your first radio gig was at 3SH, am I right?
Yep.
And that was you'd been in high school and just did you go begging, wanting some experience?
Well, yes, well, I did because at 15, I remember this moment. At the Swan Hill Show, which was a huge annual event.
Big one.
Yeah, dusty and horrible. Smelly animals, agriculture and stuff. And 3SH were broadcasting live at the show in out of a caravan. They used to do outside broadcasts, OBs, as I think they still call
them.
They
do, yep.
And they had these crappy little speakers on the top of this caravan, and I'm wandering around and I hear this song for the
over
first
the sound
time.
Of cows and horses.
Yeah,
the
and
music.
Through the dust,
yes.
I heard Like a Rolling Stone, Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
And it was like a huge awakening in my head. I thought, I don't know whether I wanted to be the Rolling Stone as a roll and go. I listened to the song on the way in today because it had such an effect on my life. It was, it made me feel that I could, maybe this was the path I could take to get out of here because I didn't want to go to university. I didn't want to be an optometrist. And so I did. The manager of the radio station, Harry Lithgow, lived on our corner. And I literally begged him for a chance to come in and do something on the air, thinking it would be a stopgap to not have to go to university just yet.
And I wonder how your parents felt about that.
Well, Dad wasn't sure about it. And when they offered me a permanent job, I think he was disappointed.
Because that happened pretty well. You in terms of you being on air alone, happened pretty quickly, didn't it?
Yeah.
It was like day three, am I right?
Yeah, day three. I was sitting in the studio and learning to do the panel with one of the guys who did afternoons, Lee Haig, his name was. Lee phoned in sick on Wednesday, and being a small country station, they didn't have a lot of spare announcers. And, and they said, Harry came in and he said, you're going to have to go on air. And I,
were you still work experience at that stage?
Not work experience. Well, sort of.
Yeah.
I was packing.
Yep.
We used to do the serials, all the Grace Gibson serials, Dad and Dave and Back to the Bible and all these things. And my job first up on Monday morning was to pack them all up and send them back, go to the post office and take them back. And I thought, this is fun. And all of a sudden, day three, I find myself on the air.
How did you go?
I was terrified. But
you made it through, though.
Yeah, I did. I did. But, we were doing the luncheon show, as it was called, reading cattle reports and pig reports,
course,
how many
you're
were sold.
Swan
Hill. Yeah, and it was, riveting stuff. But then, I get an hour where I could actually play music. And
your favourite music.
Yeah, yes.
I'm Laura Turner, and you're listening to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals. In a moment, we'll find out how young Barry Bissell, the boy in Swan Hill in the little radio station, becomes one of our most known voices on radio.
Ryan Tad is in Los Angeles at the moment doing some promotion for himself, letting the Americans know what his music is all about. It's 6:07 with Barry Bissell, and I'm going to give you three chances to crash the $15,000 secret stash till 8 o'clock. What an incredible band. Terrifying power. Blackburn Turner Overdrive. Like a sledgehammer, baby. Keep on beating me all the time. 6:11, live KA. Your first of three chances to crash the $15,000 secret stash. Coming up within 15 minutes.
Great to have your company on Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tonight, we're celebrating the life and incredible career of Barry Bissell, the man who for 21 years brought us the Take 40 countdown. He's the boy who grew up in Swan Hill. His dad wanted him to be an optician. He wanted to be a radio announcer. He had a love for music. There was a moment back then in, what was it, the 60s? 65, where you're standing at the Swan Hill show in the dust. You hear a song come over the airwaves, over the sound of the cows and the horses. It was like a Rolling Stone. And that was it. You never looked back.
I rolled on.
You rolled on away from your parents' dreams and into the local radio station. You begged for a job. You got one. Fast forward a fair while. You end up, a really well-known radio announcer in right across Australia and interviewing some huge names in music, Fleetwood Mac, Stevie Nicks being one of them.
Yeah, she was such a sweetheart too. She was a really lovely girl, pretty out there, as you know, I remember the film clip for Rhiannon, and she's, you know, the Black Witch, and she's amazing music. Landslide, I think, is one of my favourite songs of all time. Interesting, I've got a theme there, Landslide and Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
I didn't realise that.
Oh, you're a boy from the rural.
She was wonderful, and I was given 20 minutes. And it was
they rotate through the
Hilton Hotel. And I don't know what happened, whether somebody else hadn't shown up, but I finished the interview and said thanks very much to her, and she just sat back and chatted away to me. I thought, oh, God, I wish the tape was running.
Oh, she didn't feel the need to.
No, we just talked for 40 minutes.
Oh, and you'd press stop.
Yeah, well, I mean, it would have been, I don't think she would have done that had the tape been rolling. She just obviously felt comfortable
relaxed
with me and had maybe had 40 minutes up her
what
sleeve
did she
and
talk
she was
about?
Bored. It's just all sorts of stuff, just what was going on in the world and her life. And she was wonderful. She was a very insightful person. Mm. I had thought up till that time she was a bit left of centre, but not so at all. I think she struggled with the fame.
Really?
As so many people do.
Well, yes. I think it's well documented now that she did struggle with it.
Yeah.
Didn't she? Yeah.
Yeah. But she talked about it personally, like poured her heart out. Not poured her heart out. Or so,
but she addressed it.
Addressed it, yeah.
And did you, were you a big fan of hers when you were interviewing her? Was your heart in your mouth?
Yes, I was quite. I was quite intimidated. I think you have to be with people like that because you have this image in your head of what they are and what you've read about them.
Yes,
and so it can be quite intimidating. But she never, you know, as soon as I met her, I felt comfortable with her. Not so with everybody, but a lot of people were.
Another person I've heard you talk about interviewing, who is arguably the biggest star on earth, and that is Michael Jackson, and you describing him as like a little insect sitting with you backstage.
Well, I didn't actually interview him. He didn't do any interviews, but I talked to him. Mm-hmm. And what happened, he was coming here to do the Bad tour, and it had all that really incredible press about being put to sleep in a bloody chamber at night and the flotation tank and stuff. Mm. And the tour wasn't working, so the record company and the promoter sent five of us, radio and television and press, Nui Takoa, who's still going, a couple of Sydney people and Molly, sent us to Japan to see the show. Mm. And the night of the show that we were due to see, Michael called in sick, as he had a habit of doing in those days. And so we had to stay over for the next night. Was actually the second show, and they rescheduled the first night to another night. So I went to the show and I thought, oh, you know, I'm not that sure about Michael Jackson. And we were all a bit the same. We were all a bit too cool for the room, Australian radio guys. And we just stood there and went, oh, my God, because he was just, when he steps on stage, he's 20 feet tall. Mm. He was just amazing. And his strength and power and everything was mind-boggling.
And quite a contrast to the person that you would see backstage.
Totally, yes. Yeah. So we were invited, being the foreign press, to go to the promoter had a little after-party thing, and he was brought into the room. He changed into his military outfit and the hat by a minder who was about 7 foot tall, a huge black guy with a big black hat, has marched in. And his manager, who was a bit of a piece of work and smoked a large cigar like a Hollywood movie, introduced him to everybody. And we all shook his hands. And then the Japanese crew sort of just circled around him and stood and looked at him like, well, do something. And I felt really uncomfortable for him, and I sort of withdrew to a corner, and they had a replay of the show from that night playing on what in those days was a huge screen, and I was sitting there watching it, and thinking, this is really uncomfortable. I feel sorry for this poor little bugger over here,
yeah.
Being viewed at and waiting for them to do something weird. And I sat down, and the next thing, this little voice beside me said, "It's Barry, isn't it?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I'm coming to Australia." And I said, "Yeah, I know. That's why we're here." And he said, "Do they have water slides in Australia?" And I said, "Yep." And that was the introduction to a conversation. Mm-hmm. And then he just sat down and talked to me. And he was denying all the things about the deprivation chamber and everything. Yep. And Frank DeLeo, who's the manager, came over and sort of, you know, how you get the rescue.
Yes,
call.
Yep.
And he came over and he said, "Mike, it's time to go." And he said, "I'm talking to Barry." And he said, "I'm telling him about the deprivation chamber and everything and that it's not true." And he said, "Come on, Mikey, let's go." And he said, "No, I want to talk." And then they invited me back up to the room for them to watch the replay.
Right.
And
wow.
He talked some more. So it was quite an experience,
yeah.
But not an interview, but quite
but
life-changing
something a little
experience.
More than that in terms of you getting a real insight into what many people have said is that he was like a child.
He was. He was definitely like – well, that was – do they have water slides? I don't know how old he was at that stage, but he was not – he looked like he was unfit to slide down the water slide. It was just
slight,
nothing of him.
Yes,
it was tiny.
Yes, very slight.
Yeah.
Now, another one, John Travolta, a very charismatic man, isn't he?
Very charismatic.
Where did
charismatic.
You meet him?
Met him at 3XY. He came out for the launch of Grease with Olivia. Mm-hmm. He was so charismatic. He had the incredible blue eyes. When he spoke to you, he looked you straight in the eye and you couldn't not. And it was like diving into, you know, what am I going to say next? He was very giving. And then years later, he came back and I was, you know, introduced to him to go in and do my piece again in the hotel. And he said, "Oh, we've met before." And I said, "Oh, that was a long time ago."
Yeah.
I said,
he remembered
"Do you remember
as well?
The name?" And he said, "No, I remember where we were." And he said, "You're in a radio station." He said, "And it overlooked railway yards." And I said, "Yeah, that was 3XY on the fifth floor at the old age building in King Street, which overlooks Spencer Street Railway."
Yes.
Well,
there
you go. I was like, how amazing.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
One person who you weren't that impressed by being Hugh Grant. He just gave you nothing.
No, I don't think he gave anybody anything.
Yeah.
He was a strange bloke.
He was out here to promote
Mickey Blue Eyes
and just obviously was not, couldn't be bothered.
No.
Yeah.
Which I said to him at the end because I, you know, it's like, I'm sure you've had similar experiences as an interviewer. It's hard.
Getting blood from a stone.
Yeah, it is. It was like getting blood from a stone. And I just thought, he had nothing to say about anything.
Mm.
He had, you know, Liz Hurley was his appendage
bouncer.
At the time. She was around in the pink frock with the safety pins down the side.
Still wearing that.
Well, no, that
wear
was
out
that,
of it.
Yeah,
no.
That was quite a while ago.
There
very well presented.
Well, don't go anywhere. You're listening to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au and more with Barry Bissell when we return.
Barry Bissell, one-on-one with Delta Goodrum. Now, Delta, back in the 70s, before you were born, Bruce Springsteen had some dramas with his manager, which meant he wasn't able to record for a couple of years. And when he returned, he had a song called Something in the Night, which included the lines, "You're born with nothing and better off that way. Soon as you've got something, they send someone to try and take it away." Can you relate to that?
I think lots of people can relate to that. I mean, there's been a lot of people trying to come into the picture again and trying to take things when I go, you know what, this is ridiculous and I work really hard for this, but then you go, well, you just got to understand it's part and parcel with the job, and I guess that sometimes these things happen, and it's a good line.
Doesn't make it any easier though, does it?
Of course it doesn't, and sometimes we wish things would be easy, but they're not, so we've just got to deal with them the best way we know how and step over the next hurdle.
This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au for more information. Tonight we are celebrating the life of radio legend Barry Bissell, whose voice you would remember, of course, most notably from the Top 40 Countdown for 21 years. Barry, before the break, we were talking about some of the most incredible stars that you have interviewed, Michael Jackson being one you spoke to, not official interview, but you did have a long conversation with, another being Stevie Nicks. I wanted to talk about Whitney Houston as well, though, who you did have a good chat with.
I did.
What a tortured soul.
Yeah, but she broke my heart.
Did she?
She really broke. Well, just because she was clearly, was another one of those great jaunts. The record company flew me to Los Angeles.
What we might call a junket.
Yes, and quite a good junket. They flew me, and I was due to be there for like 2 days, one day to settle in and do the interview the next day.
Yep.
Then come back home. And they put me up in the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Oh, stop it. And, you know, I have wallpaper in one of my walls of my house of that banana palm, because I used to live in LA and I was obsessed with that wallpaper. Anyway, can't believe you stayed there. That's incredible.
It was like being in a movie at somebody else's expense.
Yes,
I might add.
Beautiful hotel.
So I'm sitting there and waiting for setting up to do the interview, and the record company calls me and they said, Whitney can't make it today, but we'll reschedule for tomorrow. Mm. And that happened on 3 consecutive days. And I'm still in the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Hey, who's complaining?
Dining in the restaurant, walking down Rodeo
Lounge.
Drive and having a wonderful time, thank you. Spent a lot of money.
Did you lay by the pool on the striped lounge?
Yeah, all of that. Just waiting.
Yes.
And finally on day 4 she showed up and she looked immaculate.
Yes.
But she was very shy and clearly at that stage just a little uncomfortable with what was going on in her life. And I'd made a promise to myself I wasn't going to go there. It was none of anybody else's business.
Yep.
I'm here to talk about her music and her career.
Yep.
And she was really comfortable with that. And I think she appreciated the fact that I didn't go there because, you know, it wasn't to be a sensationalist news story. It was to be about Whitney's music. That was the whole deal. And at the end of it, she relaxed into it when she knew, obviously realised it wasn't into it. And she, you know, she just talked very openly. And then at the end, she stood up and she said, thank you so much for talking to me, and gave me this huge hug.
Oh.
And I've gone, oh, my God, I've just hugged one of the most beautiful women in the world. And then, you know, like months later, you could see her starting to slide. And it was really, really sad.
Is that how she broke your heart?
Yep.
Yeah, very sad decline of Whitney Houston. And sounds like she was beautiful on the inside.
Yeah,
yeah,
definitely.
Barry, the industry today, you've sort of openly said that you, you weren't comfortable with the way things were heading when you left radio. How do you see it now?
Well, it's a very different beast. And it's, you know, radio was always, like any media, has to change too, because of, you know, when television came along, everyone said, oh, that's the end of radio. Mm. And then when colour television came along, you know, that was double the end of radio.
The internet and that's the end of television.
And videos and everything. Mm. And it's, you know, it doesn't. Radio is a transportable medium and it will never go away.
Mm.
But it's not the primary source that people go to hear music anymore.
Yes.
Music is just something I have to do to play in between the funny people and the ads to make a living. And so, you know, it had to change. But in my day, it was the source of hearing great music. You couldn't even go down and just buy it straight away. You had to order records.
Certainly can't search it on your phone.
No, there's no such thing. I mean, the concept back then that I'd be walking around with a device that I could watch music on and access that was just science fiction.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Now you are retired, but where can we still get a little fix of Barry Bissell these days?
I do some stuff with Jeff Jenkins, who was my writer I mentioned earlier for Take 40, and Andy Wells, who was the final engineer. Andy runs his own little business now, doing he does Tech Daily, a thing. He's, you know, he's a very interesting techo guy, and we come up with some specials every now and then. We've done some for Mushroom Records, for Michael, when they do new release, reissue stuff. They did the Mondo Rock.
Oh, yes.
Relaunch. And
yes.
I interviewed Ross and Eric.
Yep.
And it was great. And we talked about old times because I met Ross back in the Daddy Cool days in Adelaide in 1971.
Yep.
And we'd become quite good friends. And ironically, we just moved house a couple of years ago from Toorak to Elsternwick. And I was walking down, trying to find a new coffee shop in the area. And I'm walking down a place called Glover's Station, which I'd seen. It looked pretty good. The old service station converted to a coffee shop. And there's this guy standing out the front and he's pointing at me. And I thought, that's a familiar stance. And it's Ross. And he said, what are you doing down here? I normally see you in Hawkesburn. And I said, I just moved here. And he said, oh, really? Whereabouts? And I said, just up here in Bayview. And he said, what number? And I said, strange question.
Okay.
10. Number 10. And he said, cross the road at 19.
Ah, how funny. There you
yeah.
go. Small world.
Yep.
Well, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Thank you, Barry.
Laura, thank you very much. It was fun.
And don't forget, if you'd like to share this episode with a friend or you'd like to catch up on any of our previous shows, subscribe to the podcast and join me again the same time next week when we celebrate another great Australian life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Great Australian lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.